This audio production is brought to you by TheBestDayEver.com, David Wolf's premium longevity member site.
The content found on TheBestDayEver.com from David Wolf and New Horizon Health, Inc. is for informational purposes only and is in no way intended as medical advice, as a substitute for medical counseling, or as treatment cure for any disease or health condition, and nor should it be construed as such, because that would be illegal. Always work with a qualified health professional before making any changes to your diet, supplement use, prescription drug use, lifestyle, or exercise activities. Please understand that you assume all risks from the use, non-use, or misuse of this information.
Greetings, everybody. This is David Avocado Wolf, and we are gearing up for the Longevity Conference coming up February 7th through February 9th, 2014, at the Hyatt Regency in Orange County. That's going to be in Garden Grove, California, just south of Los Angeles. www.thelongevitynowconference.com. I am joined today by an amazing biomedical gerontologist based out of Cambridge and also Mountain View, California. He's an extraordinary voice for anti-aging. He's the editor-in-chief of Rejuvenation Research, which is the world's highest impact peer-reviewed journal focused on intervention in aging. He received his BA and PhD from the University of Cambridge in the UK in 1985 and 2000, respectively. He's been an extraordinary voice for bringing a very thorough scientific approach to increasing longevity. And with no further ado, I'd like to welcome in Dr. Aubrey de Grey. How are you doing, Dr. Grey?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. And we're so glad to have you. Let's just jump right into it. Dr. Grey, you have defined aging as the accumulation of damage to the physical body. For those of us who are new to the topic, what are the top lifestyle and environmental conditions that you see as being causative and causing the most damage in people?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that we need to be very clear that lifestyle and environmental conditions are not the main causes of damage that accumulate and eventually cause the diseases and disabilities of old age. The main cause of damage is simply the normal operation of the human body, the fact that we have to breathe, the fact that we have to eat. These things are, of course, essential for continuing life, but they also create side effects, and some of those side effects accumulate as molecular and cellular damage, which eventually the body cannot tolerate so much of, and so that's when we get the diseases and disabilities of old age. As regards lifestyle and environmental conditions, I don't really have anything new to say. The things that your mother told you are basically still true. Don't smoke, don't get overweight, you know, the usual things. But I think it's very important to understand that however much we do to optimize our lifestyle and environmental conditions, we're still going to accumulate damage at pretty much the same rate as a side effect of being alive in the first place. And that's why we need, absolutely everybody needs medicines, more sophisticated medicines than what we have today, the sorts of medicines that Sense Research Foundation and others are trying to develop so as to alleviate and indeed eliminate the diseases and disabilities of old age.
Tell us about Sense for a second, and then we'll get into the goals of your organization.
Sure. Sense Research Foundation is a public charity based in California. We're a 501c3, and our aim is to develop medicines and disseminate those medicines that will prevent and eliminate the diseases and disabilities of old age. So we are directly attacking these various types of molecular and cellular damage that accumulate, as I say, mainly as a side effect of being alive in the first place.
So your goal then with Sense is not just slowing down the rate of damage, of metabolic damage caused by living, but actually even to reverse and halt the aging process altogether. Is that a reasonable statement?
That is a reasonable statement, yes. The big insight that I had about 13 years ago now, which led to the work that I do and that Sense Research Foundation does, was that repairing and eliminating these various types of molecular and cellular damage is actually going to be a great deal easier than the traditional approach that people had contemplated in the past, which was essentially to tune up our metabolism so that these types of damage are not created as rapidly in the first place. stopping the damage from being created sounds, on the face of it, like it would be the easiest thing to do. You know, slowing aging down should be easier than reversing aging. But when you think about the question properly, it's easier to see that it's actually just the same way that we actually maintain simple man-made machines like a car or an aeroplane, that we do preventative maintenance periodically. We don't stop the rust from actually being created. We just get rid of the rust every so often so that there's not so much of it that the doors fall off.
Well, I think what you're getting at is the really interesting idea. If you set a goal, you get a goal. So we might as well go for the whole goal, which is to reverse the whole darn thing anyway. Right?
That's exactly right, yes.
That's the logic, and it's brilliant logic. You've got the aging process broken down into seven major classes of damage and repair.
That's correct,
yes. Can you break that down for us real quickly? Because that's something that I became aware of recently in your research, and I really wanted to hear it from you exactly how you've categorized this.
Yes, sure. So, of course, there are many, many, many different types of damage that the body creates as a side effect of its normal operation. And in order to get my arms around the whole question of how we might go about this repair process, I needed, as a starting point, to identify a way of classifying those various types of damage so as to be able to essentially break the enormous problem down into a manageable number of sub-problems. And the breakthrough that I made back in 2000 of realizing that we could do this with just seven major categories of damage was essential to allowing this work to begin. So let's go through those seven categories. Three of them are at the cellular level, and the other four are at the molecular level. So what that means is that, first of all, we've got three ways in which you can have the wrong number of cells in one another sense, and then four ways in which the cells or the material between cells can be somehow damaged or dysfunctional. So let's do the cellular ones first. The first one is simply having too few cells, cells dying and not being automatically replaced by the division of other cells. That's a very simple concept, and it happens in a few of the most important aspects of aging. The example that I like to use, with probably because it's the simplest one, is Parkinson's disease, where there's a particular part of the brain in which neurons, brain cells, die more rapidly than they do in most parts of the brain. And, of course, that means that since those neurons are not replaced, the eventual outcome is that you don't have enough of those cells. And that's when you get Parkinson's disease. So the way in which we propose to repair that is actually not a new idea at all. It's just a concept that everyone has been looking at for a long time. It's simply stem cell therapy. So this is not a new idea that we have. It's just that it fits in as one component of the seven-point plan. Okay. Stem cell therapy is the repair of inadequate numbers of cells. So the other two types of cellular damage both consist of having too many cells. And here, the way in which we have too many cells, there could be two ways in which that happens. One is if we have cells dividing when they're not supposed to, and that, of course, is what cancer is. That's the definition of cancer, essentially. And the other is cells not dying when they are supposed to. That's a concept that a lot of people overlook because we don't normally think in terms of it being a good idea for cells to die. But there are certain parts of the way the body works that do rely on cells dying on schedule. A great example of this is the immune system, in which when we get an infection, there's an enormous proliferation of a very tiny minority of cells that happen to be specifically set up to address that one infection. And when the infection is defeated, the cells that did that have to die, or almost all of them have to die. So it's essentially to make space for the proliferation of a different set of cells when we get a different infection later on. That process stops happening so efficiently when we get old. The cells that are supposed to die often don't die, and they continue to take up space and inhibit the proliferation of cells for the next infection. That's a large part of why the immune system doesn't work so well late in life. And so in order to fix these two problems, well, first of all, let's take cancer. Of course, there are many, many people trying many, many different approaches to attacking cancer. We have a particular approach that we're taking, which essentially is a souped-up version of one of the traditional approaches, trying to stop cells from extending the ends of their chromosomes when they divide. this is something that a lot of people have been working on for a while, and we're just taking it another couple of steps forward. But there are many other approaches to defeating cancer, and it doesn't really matter which one works. For getting rid of cells that are not dying when they're supposed to, the approach that we're pursuing is something called suicide gene therapy, which sounds terribly sophisticated and scary, but actually it's a routine technique that is used in the lab all the time, and it's not all that far away from becoming something that could be used in the clinic. So this is something that we're quite excited about using. So I've dealt with now the three types of cellular damage. Let's move on to the molecular ones. And these fall into two categories, some things that happen inside the cell and some things that happen outside in the spaces between cells. So inside the cell, the two types of damage that we need to address are mitochondrial mutations and molecular garbage. So mitochondrial mutations. Mitochondria are a special part of the cell that's essential for a number of different things, but in particular, it's essential for doing what we can call the chemistry of breathing. In other words, combining oxygen that we breathe in with nutrients that we eat in order to extract energy from those nutrients that can be used to do all the things that cells and the body has to do. And that process, that chemical process, is extremely complex and sophisticated, and it doesn't always work right, and it creates free radicals. It's the main source of free radicals in the body. But the thing that we're focusing on is the fact that mitochondria don't just have this really difficult thing to do, they also have their own DNA, their own little chromosome, a little bit like the chromosomes, in fact, very like the chromosomes that we have in the nucleus, but much, much smaller. It only encodes 13 proteins as against many, many thousands of proteins that are encoded in the nuclear DNA. But those 13 proteins are absolutely essential, and so what we need to do is make sure that those proteins continue to get made by our cells in order to carry on allowing them to extract energy from nutrients. And it turns out that mitochondrial DNA does accumulate mutations just like the nuclear DNA, but it turns out that it happens much, much, much more quickly than in the nuclear DNA. So this becomes a serious problem, or at least we think it does. And we want to fix that, and the way that we're approaching that problem is essentially to make this mitochondrial DNA unnecessary, to make it superfluous by putting modified copies of it into the nuclear DNA, which, as I just mentioned, is a great deal better protected and accumulates mutations much, much more slowly than the mitochondrial DNA does. This is an idea that, again, has been around for quite some time, maybe about 30 years now, and a lot of people thought for a long time that it couldn't be done. But we are getting somewhere, and indeed there has been progress, a number of pieces of progress over the past couple of, well, over the past 10 years, I guess, which have led to a good deal of optimism that we can get this to work now. So now let's move on to the other type of molecular problem inside the cell, which is molecular garbage. And here I literally mean garbage, molecules that are byproducts of things that the cell normally does, and which accumulate in the cell simply because the cell doesn't have any machinery to break them down or to excrete them, to just chuck them out. So, of course, as with other types of damage, the cell is set up to tolerate a certain amount of this garbage, but eventually there's too much of it and you get problems. And it turns out that some of the very most prevalent and important diseases of old age are caused by this type of damage. First of all, cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, which, of course, is the main cause of heart attacks and strokes, the number one killer in the Western world. That's caused by the accumulation of a certain type of oxidized cholesterol inside cells of the walls of our arteries. It's also the main cause of macular degeneration, the main cause of blindness in the elderly. In that case, it's a different type of molecule that accumulates, but it's still a molecule that the cell doesn't know how to deal with. So in both of these cases, we have research projects that we're pursuing that are involved in trying to get rid of this stuff. And the way we're doing it is by identifying other species, usually bacteria, which have the machinery, have enzymes that can break down these things. So if we can find such species, then we can find the enzymes, and then we can modify the enzymes so that we can introduce them into our own human cells in such a way that the cells can break down this stuff that they can't naturally break down. And we've been making great progress in that project over the past several years. Just last year, we were able to show for the first time that in cell culture in the lab, we could actually protect cells from this number one molecule, this type of oxidized cholesterol that is public enemy number one causing cardiovascular disease. And we are very optimistic now that within not very many years, we will have a treatment for atherosclerosis that will be vastly more effective than anything we have today, anything like statins or stents or anything like that. So we're pretty happy about that. All right, so finally, let's move on to the last two types of damage, which are both things that happen outside the cell. And outside the cell, we again have a problem of molecular garbage, molecules that are created as byproducts of normal metabolism, but the body doesn't know how to get rid of them. And in this case, the main one that we're talking about is something called amyloid. Amyloid is made of proteins, and they get sort of into aggregates, into like lumps that the body doesn't get rid of properly. And about 15 years ago, people discovered in mice that for the particular type of amyloid that we see in Alzheimer's disease, it's possible to eliminate it, essentially stimulating the immune system to recognize these clumps of protein as foreign, a bit like an infection, and to get them inside the cell. Once they're inside the cell, it turns out that they go away pretty quickly because the machinery that we have inside the cell for breaking things down, even though it's not perfect or else we wouldn't get cardiovascular disease and macular degeneration, it's a lot more sophisticated than it is outside the cell. So that's enough to get rid of this stuff. And that actually has moved on very, very effectively already. There have already been phase 3 clinical trials for eliminating the amyloid of Alzheimer's disease in humans. It's not a complete cure for Alzheimer's because there are other things that happen in Alzheimer's as well. But it does work. It gets rid of the amyloid. And there are other parts of aging which are also caused by amyloid. So we're pursuing some other parallel projects using the same philosophy and approach. And we're very optimistic that it's going to help in a number of other types of illness associated with aging. All right. So finally, number 7, which is again outside the cell, as I mentioned. Here, the problem is not garbage, but rather damage to molecules that we need. And the molecules in this case are molecules that make up something called the extracellular matrix. The extracellular matrix is a kind of lattice of proteins that are linked together in a regular array, and they hold our tissues together, they give them the shape that they have, and they are elastic, these molecules. And that elasticity turns out to be vital for how the extracellular matrix works, especially in certain cases like the walls of our major arteries. So I mentioned atherosclerosis already. There's also something called arteriosclerosis, which is nothing to do with cholesterol, it's just to do with hardening of the arteries, loss of elasticity, essentially stiffening of the arteries. That happens because of chemical changes that occur to the extracellular matrix.
Fantastic. That was an amazing list there. A lot of that's new stuff. I mean, I hear some similar ideas like the stiffening of the arteries and number 7 there. That has to do with the accumulation of calcium and the hardening of the tissue. And that's very interesting research. I liked what you said about, where was that back on? There was a whole thing on stem cell therapy way back on replacing or getting more cells to actually rejuvenate. That was also interesting. And then there was a lot of interesting stuff about mitochondria. Now, you mentioned DNA, you mentioned the mitochondrial DNA, then we've got our own nuclear DNA in each side, each major cell in the body other than the red blood cells. Tell us about what the role of genetics is in all this and epigenetics, and how does that fit in and map onto what your research directives are?
Right. So, of course, there's an enormous buzz about genetics and aging at the moment, just as there is about genetics and pretty much everything else. And this has arisen largely because over the past decade or so, and even as time goes on, it's becoming easier and easier and cheaper to obtain genetic information about an individual. So what we would like is to find information that we could use to minimize or indeed possibly, well, somehow address and postpone age-related ill health in people as a result of their genetics. But unfortunately, there's some bad news here, which is that everyone's got aging. You know, it doesn't matter whether your genes are good or bad, you're still getting all of these 7 problems that I've listed. The only real difference is that some people will get those problems a little bit more slowly or a little bit more rapidly than other people. So then we might think, well, okay, even if it's only a small amount, let's say 20% difference between someone who's going to live to 80 and someone who's going to live to 100, then still, that's a big difference. Maybe we can actually apply that and take people who would normally only live to 80 and improve their genetics or somehow exploit their genetics anyway so they live to 100. But there's a problem there as well, which is that we would typically be applying any of these therapies to people who are not in infancy or in childhood anymore, but rather they're already, let's say, 60 or 70. If you're already 70 and you're going to live to 80 and we slow down your aging by 20%, then you're going to live to like 82. You know, that's better than nothing, but it's not exactly dramatic. So I'm not really much of a believer in the idea that the route one for getting people to stay healthy longer and therefore to stay alive longer is to exploit genetics. Mm-hmm. I think there will be certain, there will definitely be value in, you know, in personalizing any medicine so as to optimize its efficacy for a given individual, but we must always regard that as a kind of icing on the cake to get us to squeeze a little bit more out of a therapy rather than to be the main, you know, central plank of the therapy.
I completely agree with you. I think genetics are, in this world, in the realm of longevity, is overrated. And what we really should be working on is more of the unique theories and processes that you've been working on. I think you're more on the right track. Let's talk a little bit about the immune system. You talked about this problem that can be generated. It's basically when you have too many cells and cells are not dying when they're supposed to. For example, yep. You have an immunological reaction. You know, your body ramps up to fight the infection and then those immune system cells stay around. That was interesting. What are your thoughts about the overall power of the immune system and its anti-aging effects or lack thereof? And how does the immune system fit into your overall strategy? I mean, does it work its way outside of just that one category, or how broad acting is this? It seems to be a big subject.
It certainly is a big subject. So the immune system is often underrated in terms of its role in the body. People think that it's there for, fighting infections, but it's there for much more than that. The big thing that one needs to take into account is that the immune system also eliminates certain things from the body that the body creates on its own. And the biggest example of this is actually cancer. When a cancer gets big enough to be, therapeutically relevant, to be actually diagnosed, it's already jumped through a million hoops in terms of escaping the body's own anti-cancer defenses. And many of those defenses are actually immune defenses. The immune system recognizes various aspects of cancer cells that distinguish them from normal cells, and it attacks those things. And the cancer has to somehow escape those attacks in order to be able to get big enough to be a problem. So, when the immune system goes downhill late in life, that is certainly something that can, in principle, contribute to the accelerated incidence of cancer.
Interesting. Okay. Let's just say that we have really good immunological nutrition. We've been taking our favorite herbs. You know, we've been working on that kind of a thing. We've been eating really well. We have the environmental and lifestyle factors that are working for us. And now we're interested in moving forward with like the next great anti-aging medicine. What's leading the pack right now? Is there anything? What is the summation of your research in that regard? Is there anything we can take, anything we can do that will block telomere damage or any of that kind of thing, in your opinion?
So I believe that at the moment, we are pretty much at square one with regard to things that are already available. So I mentioned at the beginning, of course, that I still believe that the main things we can do in terms of lifestyle and preventative approaches are simply the things that we already knew 100 years ago, or at least 50 years ago, like not smoking and not getting overweight. I wish we could do more. You know, certainly I know that there are a great many supplements out there that are touted to make a difference, but the actual difference that they make is probably very, very small, even if they are beneficial at all. And, you know, I wish I could say more. And certainly even a very tiny difference in terms of postponing age-related ill health has value for not only in improving people's quality of life that little bit, but also in slightly increasing their chances of being around in a healthy state long enough to benefit from future medicines of the sort that Sense Research Foundation is developing. But yeah, I mean, at the moment, my view is that the only people who will really benefit substantially from the anti-aging technologies of all kinds that we have today are people who are starting out worse off than average. In other words, who have some particular metabolic problem, whether a congenital one or other, that is causing some aspect of their aging to happen unusually rapidly. I'm often asked about Ray Kurzweil, another prominent person in the anti-aging field,
who
is is well known to take probably a couple of hundred supplements each day. You know, that's pretty extreme. And one might ask whether he's wasting his money and his time. But actually, he may well not be, because Ray is one of these unlucky people. He has a lot of cardiovascular disease in his family. He also came down with type 2 diabetes in his 30s, which is, you know, it's not unknown, but it's pretty rare. And he developed his own regime for addressing that, and he was completely successful. He's now in his mid-60s, and he hasn't had a hint of diabetes ever since. So he's done extremely well there. For those of us who are not unlucky and who have a pretty good chance of getting to the age of 80 without too much trouble and maybe a little beyond, at the moment, my view is that the overwhelming balance of evidence is that there's essentially nothing we can do to get a significant further delay of age-related ill health. And therefore, the requirement is to work as hard as we can to hasten the development of medicines that we don't yet have, medicines of the kind that I've been describing, so that we can actually do something for people who are not just unlucky.
Okay, so like basically your opinion is that if we take the best supplements and best things ever, we might get maybe 10%, you know, add on, maybe 20% if we're really, really lucky, but it's not really significant, like doubling lifespan. Okay, out of all of the things that you focus on with Sense and where your research is going, what has you the most excited? What is the biggest breakthrough that you've had?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, you see, it's quite difficult for someone like me who's right in the thick of all of this, because I'm, as a scientist, I'm watching all of this research going on, and, you know, things, there may be things that excite me that it would take me half an hour just to give you enough background to understand the point of, the significance of. So for me, you know, it's a fantastic time to be in this field. It's, you know, there is exciting stuff happening all over the place. But if I stand back and I ask, you know, what's the most exciting in terms of its bottom line for the general public, there are a few highlights, I guess. I would say the number one highlight is something I've already mentioned, this business of addressing cardiovascular disease using genes and enzymes found in bacteria. This was an enormous breakthrough that we had last year when we were able to show that we could modify a bacterial gene, put it into human cells in culture, and the enzyme that this gene would create was able to protect those human cells from concentrations of this toxic molecule 7-ketocholesterol that would normally kill the cells if they didn't have the gene. And this molecule, 7-ketocholesterol, is, you know, well established, has been known for a long time to be public enemy number one in atherosclerosis. There are various other similar molecules that are also contributors that accumulate in the artery wall and are bad for our cells, but 7-ketocholesterol is the most abundant and the most toxic, so it's the one that we've been going after. And we believe that if we can introduce this enzyme into cells in such a way that 7-ketocholesterol is no longer a problem, then atherosclerosis will be pretty much cured. It will be a complete transformation of how we can address this number one killer in the Western world. As we know, statins, you know, they are better than nothing. They do actually reduce the amount of oxidized cholesterol in the arteries, but only at the expense of also reducing the amount of total cholesterol that is actually synthesized by the body. And normal cholesterol is a good molecule. It's an essential molecule. So that means, of course, there's only so far we can go with something like statins. Similarly, if we resort to surgery late in the day in atherosclerosis and try to keep arteries open using stents, well, we all know that that's a very short-term, temporary fix. It's something that we want to try to avoid, especially since, obviously, surgery is always very invasive and dangerous. So, yeah, we're really excited about this.
That is fantastic, and thank you for that. It's so awesome. For those of you who are just joining us right now or came in late in the game, I'm speaking with Dr. Aubrey de Grey. He's a biomedical gerontologist, amazing researcher, and we're gearing up. He's going to be speaking at the upcoming Longevity Now conference. We're going to be at the Hyatt Regency in Orange County. That's Garden Grove, California, just south of Los Angeles. And that's Friday, February 7th through Sunday, February 9th, 2014. Dr. de Grey, what do you think is the main contribution that you're bringing to the Longevity Conference? Maybe you could give us a little bit of a teaser about what you're going to be talking about there.
I expect that what I'll mainly focus on is the sorts of things that you've been asking me about during this call, actually, because what I found is that certainly the sorts of audiences that I speak to around the world and that I expect will be present at your conference are relatively well informed about what's available today, though possibly somewhat over optimistic about the potential benefits that can be obtained from those things, but they're not very well informed about research that's coming down that might actually lead to products in the clinic within the next 10 or 20 years. Now, of course, one could argue that, well, you know, things that are not in the clinic yet, you've got to worry about them when they arrive. But I think that it's very important to educate people that that's a short-sighted view to take, and that if they understand more about what's coming, then they will be able to do something. They will be able to make a contribution to the crusade to hasten the development of these therapies, whether it's by, you know, donating money to the research, or whether it's by getting involved in the research themselves, or whether it's by just advocacy, talking to their friends and family and colleagues and writing to their elected representatives and so on. So I spend a lot of my time speaking at conferences and giving interviews so as to educate the general public on what's coming down and how enormously transformational it's going to be as compared to the very modest impact that today's medicines can have.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Aubrey de Grey. You've been an amazing interviewee, and I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us, as everyone who's listening is appreciating you. We really love the side of you, by the way, and my audience, I'm sure, feels the same sentiment, but my team definitely feels this, the side of you that is, you are a British scientist. I love the way that you speak. You're very, very clear and very specific, and thanks for bringing that energy to the longevity sciences.
It's my pleasure.
Awesome. Okay, so that was Dr. Aubrey de Grey. I'm David Wolf. We're signing off from the hyperspace realm known as the internet, and we are going to be all coming together in real life in the physical on Friday, February 7th through Sunday, February 9th, 2014 at the Hyatt Regency in Orange County to experience the magic of the Longevity Conference. We will see you there. Have the best day ever.
This program was brought to you by thebestdayever.com. Thanks for listening.